Just for the sake of orientation to what we are about and where we'll be over the course of our three times, if you're here for tomorrow, when you're here tomorrow, we'll be discussing, at least looking at, some of the chunks or paragraphs out of the book of Ephesians. This is a delightful book that was written. I'm sure you're familiar with it in many ways, because it's one of the most famous books of the New Testament, because it is unique in the sense that it was not written with any particular reason. Many of the New Testament books were written because Paul was correcting a situation in the place where he was writing to. 1 Corinthians, for example, or Titus, setting up elders. There's a reason for writing. Ephesians was not written with any reason in mind. Paul just had the opportunity to sit down and say, what can I say to those people? And he wrote us a book that stands amongst his epistles as one of the great epistles because of that reason. It contains theology that we find, although it's parallel to some degree in Colossians, but he fleshes things out in this book that we don't see otherwise. Anyways, I'm giving you some trivia that you don't need to know, but just for the sake of orientation and regards to where we'll be. We're looking at chapter 4 this morning, this afternoon. Just before we do, I want to read to you the standard of conduct for members of the Sleepy Hollow Country Club, which happens to be in Stouffville, Ontario. This is randomly selected from their website, and I'll read to you the standard of conduct. If you want to be a golfer, you must maintain courteous relationships with the club employees, fellow members, and guests. Uphold the highest standard of personal conduct so as to reflect the image and stature of the club. Familiarize yourself with and abide by the spirit and rules and regulations. Observe the highest standards of conduct and integrity when representing the club at outside events. Conduct conduct of any member that is detrimental to the best interests of the club will be immediately referred to directors, and you are in trouble. So if you want to golf here, by the way, this is just a preamble. This goes into all kinds of conflict and harassment and language usage. If you want to golf at this particular country club, I'm not picking on them, I'm just stating, there is a standard of conduct that you know even before you join them. I say that to say this is what Paul is doing in Ephesians. He is laying out for us the standard of conduct that is expected of every believer. One thing you'll notice in the standard of conduct at the Sleepy Hollow Country Club is they have no standard of dress code, which explains why you see all kinds of hideous things in all kinds of whack attire, because that's what you do at the golf club, I guess, so you don't get hit by a ball. But just for the sake, again, a bit of trivia for you, but just to orient you as we head into chapter 4, I want to just express that the book is divided very, very nicely, chapters 1 to 3, and then chapters 4 to 6 are entirely different. The first three chapters are theology, and the last three chapters are practical living. In fact, if you wanted to look at it this way, there are 41 commands in the book of Ephesians. One of them is found in the first three chapters. There are 40 commands in the remaining three chapters. That gives you some sense of how Paul is expressing the importance of Christian living. By the way, the one command in the first three is remember. Remember at one time, you Gentiles in the flesh, remember that you were far off. That's as close as he comes to a command. So this, and we're not going through 40 commands. I'm just trying to give you some orientation to the text and to the book itself. So we begin at the hinge. Chapter 4, verse 1, is the hinge where he stops talking all theology, and he now goes into the practical, or as we would say, the spiritual conduct that is expected of every believer. That's why the first word, or nearly the first word, you find in chapter 4 is the word therefore. This is the hinge that the book turns the corner on. Because of everything I've said in the first three chapters, therefore, I'm now going to tell you how to live. Now, you notice, just by way of orientation again to the text, as we look at the first six verses here, that he uses this phrase, he is a prisoner for the Lord. Now, I don't know why particularly Paul would have put that, except that he wanted his readers to recognize and acknowledge that he is in prison, not because Rome has decided he has broken a law. If you remember in the book of Acts, Paul gets captured, he gets put on a ship, and there's a shipwreck just trying to get him to trial. And at the trial, they can find nothing wrong with him, but they put him in prison anyways. And Paul does not mention himself as a prisoner of Rome. No, Paul calls himself a prisoner of the Lord. I'm in prison, he says, because of the gospel that I preach. I'm in prison because of the truth that I hold to. Now, I think one of the reasons for pointing that out is just so that the reader and even us today would acknowledge and recognize, why would we listen to a prisoner? If a prisoner wrote you a letter and he had some instructions for you on how you're supposed to live your life, you might want to crumple that up and toss it in the bin. It doesn't hold a lot of credibility. But here he now states, so that every reader understands, oh, Paul, that guy who's in prison? No, no, no. He's not in prison because of Rome. He's in prison because of the gospel. It's God who has put him there, and he is a prisoner of Jesus. And he has, as it were, though he's probably literally chained to a guard, Paul is saying, I'm chained to Jesus. What he is my master, he's my Lord, and he is the one who is giving these instructions. So although that seems like a superfluous little phrase to us in the 21st century, it's actually key to part of what he's saying. And then he says this, he uses this word, urge. I therefore, as a prisoner of the Lord, urge you. Now that's a good translation of the Greek, and I don't want to treat you like imbeciles here this morning, or this afternoon, I don't know who you are. So quick explanation that the Bible was originally written in what is called Koine Greek, Koine is the Greek word for common. It is ancient Greek. There's now a Greek that's called modern Greek. This Greek is as old to them today as old English is when we hear Elizabethan English. It's English, but not really. That's the biblical Greek. And so because it was written in an original language, sometimes there's subtleties that we find in that language that we don't quite grasp when we bring it into another language. And if you know two languages, as Rob was saying earlier, there is a difference when you bring a word from one language into another. So for the sake of some clarity, let me just point out to you that this word urge in Greek is actually two words. It's a compound word, parakaleo, and it means to beseech or to urge, to encourage, to implore, to beg. Okay, this is why we use the word I urge you. But it's a compound word. You know what compound words are? You might say roommate. So he has a mate who lives in your room. Compound word is two words that we've mashed together to make a third word. This word, para, means alongside of, which is where we get our English word parallel, which is why we call it a parable, which is one story alongside another story. And the second word is kaleo, that means to call. And the idea, the concept of this word, when he says, I urge you, he's actually saying, in essence, I am coming right up alongside you. I am standing right beside you, and I'm begging you. I am personally coming to you right alongside where you are, and I am asking you, I am begging you, I am telling you, you must listen to me, because I am urging you in the Lord. Well, I don't know if we're pausing here. Is there drips that we need to be aware of with all this electronic? We're not going to be electrocuted.
We'll be fine.
Press on. Ignore the weather, people. Just be thankful it's not hot. So he is telling us, I'm urging you. So here you have this hinge in the book where Paul is now turning the corner, and his first explanation to us is where he's standing. I am a prisoner for the Lord, and I'm personally coming to you and begging you to walk. This is a great word. This, again, is a compound word that it simply means walk, putting one foot in front of another. You know from Paul's epistles that he means this. Your duct tape is failing. Just saying. He means this He means this as a metaphorical word. He means this as a word that doesn't mean literally putting your one foot in front of another. He means this as a course of life, as a way to live. And this is because, hey, if this bothers you, you don't know the faith mission, okay? That this is normal stuff. Okay, we have meetings in barns and fields. Just be thankful you're not getting soaking wet. I once was at a meeting with Brian Spence, who worked with the mission. He was an Irish guy. And he talked at his meeting that one of the meetings he was at was in a cow barn. And he was in a cow barn for the whole meeting. And people were sitting on hay bales and during in the cow barn. And you could see the Canadians going, what? What is he saying? Is that English? So I got up when I was to speak and I said, I have two words for you. Cow barn. And immediately everyone went, oh, it was a cow barn. Who knows what a cow barn is? These Irishmen don't even know how to speak the language. God bless their peanut heads. Anyways, please ignore the weather and let's just press on. I know you are. So here we have this word that he's using as this metaphor that we use to put our feet in front of each other to talk about how we live. And the reason for this, or one of the reasons for this, is because, again, this is a compound word. Peripateo. Peri means something that is comprehensive, or something that goes all the way around. And pateo is just to put your foot down, to stomp your foot down, to walk. So he's actually using this word that talks about walking, as it were, in a complete circle. And he's ultimately saying that every aspect of your life, every part of your entire life, in all that is encompassed, I am asking you to walk, and then he says, in a manner that is worthy of the calling to which you have been called. Now, I personally find this quite fascinating, this use of this word. I'm sure you don't, but that's okay. I'm going to pretend you do. And I'm going to tell you that this word worthy in the original is actually the word axios. The word axios is not fancy in any way. It just genuinely means to be worthy. But what's interesting is that in English, it is our root word for axis. Do you know what an axis is? An axis is an invisible or an imaginary line that runs between two sides. So there's this earth spins on its axis, right? It's an imaginary line and it divides things. So how did we get a word, axis, that talks about dividing things and end up with a word manner, or excuse me, the word worthy? That's because the ancient idea of this word actually goes back to the dividing line regarding a set of scales. Now, I'm not old enough to have bought anything with scales. Maybe some of you are, but I know that there was a day when there was a dividing line between what was on this side and what is on that side of the scales. And you would go into a store or a mercantile and you would put your pound of sugar on this side, and then they would put a pound weight on this side, and you would find out if the pound weight actually equals or is worthy of a pound. Is what is on this side equal to what is on that side? Is this sugar worthy of being called a pound? And that's the ancient etymology of how we got this word, even from the original Greek right into English, and it now is called, he's telling us, he wants us to walk in a manner that is equal to. So if you're going to put all that Christ has done for you on this side, and all that he says about us in the first three chapters on this side, I now want your behavior, your conduct, to equal everything that Christ has done. Your conduct, the code of conduct you're being called to, is equal to the calling to which you have been called. That is what he says. I, as a prisoner for the Lord, urge you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling to which you have been called. Your calling, your life, needs to be equal to the call of the gospel on your life. Now, if you know the first three chapters at all, you know that there is a lot of deep theology that has expressed what Christ has done for us and in us and through us. Quick list, just to give you a really quick run through. but you'll be happy we're not looking at the first three chapters, but just to remind you, give you a bit of an understanding if you don't know the text or the book. The book starts and he tells us that he chose us in him before the foundations of the world. So here you have that God, you were on God's mind. He predestined you. That means he saw the destination before you were even born. He declared that you would be his. He predestined us for adoption. You were outside of God. You had no father as God. You were separated from him. That you were so far from him that you were going to justly fall under his wrath. That you were justly going to be punished for all of eternity separated from him. But he has destined you. He has ordained that you would be his. He adopted you and he redeemed you. He bought you through his blood. In him, now, once you were separated from Christ, you've now received an inheritance. You were sealed. So this means now, though you were far away, you've been brought in and the Spirit of God has sealed you. You are promised that this inheritance is yours. It is guaranteed. You may have been made alive with Christ. You were dead in your trespasses and sins in which you once walked, following the course of the world, following the prince of the power of the air. You were dead. You had no spiritual interest. He's made you alive. And not only did he make you spiritually alive, he seated you now in heavenlies with Christ. And you have been created, redeemed, and rescued, and adopted for one purpose, for good works. Not to live your life on your terms, for good works, and you have been made a member of the household of God. And now he is calling you to recognize that you were separated, you were far away, you were without God and without hope, but Christ has changed you. And now the calling on your life is to live your life in such a way that it is equal to what Christ has done in you. You are not your own. You have been bought with a price. Therefore, glorify God in your body. This is what he says ultimately, the same idea in Philippians 1, verse 27. Let your manner of life be worthy of the gospel of Christ. There is a call for us to live according to a standard of conduct based entirely on who we are and what we have been made in Christ. So what is that standard of conduct? What does it look like? This is the text that we'll spend a bit of time in our remaining time together. With all humility. This is actually an interesting concept because in the ancient world, Roman world, there was no concept of humility. It was considered a weakness. If you were humble in any way, you were to promote yourself. This idea of humility is entirely a Christian, early Christian thought, that this idea that you would actually be meek and humble within yourself. This word, giant word in Greek, is actually, again, just means to have a mindset, a humble opinion of yourself, and that is because it comes in two parts. Again, Paul loves the compound words. Tapenos, which means to be humble or lowly, and phronosis, which means wisdom. So you're to have a perspective, a smart perspective of yourself. You're to be thinking of yourself with a correct point of view. He says you are to be humble. Have a humble opinion of yourself. Now most of us know what humility looks like because most of us know humility. In fact, many of us are right now thinking how phenomenal we are at being humble. But we actually don't even need to talk about it because I'm already so good at it that it's basically amazing how humble I am. You know humility when you see humility, but this calling, you notice this? This is the very first list on the list that he has of our code of conduct. How should you be behaving? Humbly. What was the very first sin that came into being? It was pride. The very first sin was pride. And what happened when Satan fell? The very first human choice, the very first sin of human choice, pride. And what is Paul's reaction to our state of behavior amongst ourselves and to carry our Christian conduct? Humility. I don't know if you are familiar with F.B. Mayer. He wrote a number of books in his age, in his day, and he was well known for writing on holiness. And he was so well known for writing on holiness that other people looked at him as if surely he must be a tremendously holy person. He must be such a godly man. F.B. Meyer wrote to a friend a few weeks before his death, and he wrote this: "I am now 82 and in a nursing home. I want to tell you what the Spirit of God has been showing me lately, that I have acquired a reputation for sanctity by my books. This may grow upon me. It makes one want to creep into heaven unnoticed." So here's a man who writes about holiness his entire life, and he knows his own heart. He knows who he really is and what he's really like. And though he knows the standard to be called to holiness, and other people look at him as holy, when he considers his own life, it's like, I just want to tiptoe into the back row of heaven. I don't even deserve to be there. This, when you read this, it just smacks of humility. He's not even realizing in himself how lowly he's thinking of his own spiritual state. You know as well the opposite of humility. You know it all too well. Because if I can say politely without stomping on your toes, this is your biggest problem. Because you are a human being. Your biggest, single most struggle in your life is pride. You know what pride looks like? Just a quick few examples. It is you constantly needing recognition. You can't wait till the person you're talking to stops talking so that you can now talk about yourself. You need them to know what your holiday was like. You need them to hear what you did for a living. You need them to know how bad your day was. I happen to have a member of my family, I mean no disrespect, and of course I'm being recorded, so I'm being careful, but there is a need for whatever story you tell. I can guarantee you, your story will be upped. You have no idea what you could possibly create as a scenario. And I promise you, your scenario it pales in comparison to whatever this person has experienced. You could say, you won't believe it, but I was just in a tornado and my entire house got wiped out. And the retort would be, you have no idea. I not only lived through a tornado, I lived through a tornado and a flood in the same week. And not only my house was wiped out, but I lost 2 children in the process. You have no idea. I promise you, they are so determined to always have, they don't even know it. Is this you? They don't even know that pride has such a continual grip that it's almost a personality defect that is so ingrained in them, blind to it, and have no idea that the only person in the universe that matters is me. And if that's not you, you're lying to yourself, because this is our human condition. We have a tendency to love ourselves more than anyone else, talk about ourselves, promote ourselves. We are full of pride. Pride is you needing to have your own way. It is you listening to somebody, filtering what they're saying, and in the moment, you can hardly wait till they're done talking because you need to correct them. Oh, you don't know how to do that. You don't really know how to get there. You don't really understand. Let me tell you what you need to know. And there is a desire, a drive to be in charge, to have my way, which is better than your way. Whatever your way is, it's fine. But I'll tell you the way this should be done. I know. And if you don't think this is true, try checking out the internet and all the comments that come when somebody says something public. They shouldn't say that. They need to know this. You've said that wrong. They have a tendency to be critical. This is paramount. This is so typical of a proud heart. People love to point out your mistake. They can't wait to leap the pews to tell you that you misspoke a word in the middle of while you were preaching. Don't tell me that's not true. That you make a typo in the church bulletin. By the way, See all these circles here? These are all the mistakes that you... Why are you telling me this? It's done. It's in print. What are you going to do? What am I going to do? Reprint it? I don't care. But you love the fact that you found them. And you know. And you saw someone else made a boo-boo. And someone's got them. And I get to show you how smart I am. Your pride rules your life. And you don't even know it. And it's in charge. And it controls you, and you call it a personality defect, and other people look at you like, what's his problem? But you don't even realize there's no humility. You're not equal to the calling to which you've been called. Pride rules your life. There's a concern for what others think. This is the opposite side of pride. We often think of pride as somebody who is arrogant, who is full of themselves, and they have this exaggerated notion of someone who walks around like a peacock. Don't be fooled. The devil has two sides to this thing. The devil also lets you think that you're humble when you're just as arrogant as everybody else. And you're going to tell yourself at a prayer meeting, oh, I couldn't pray. I don't know how to pray like him. He prays so well. He's such, oh no, I couldn't pray. I wouldn't want to, no, I couldn't. But that's your pride. That's your pride. You are afraid to embarrass yourself. And your pride says, I might sound foolish, I might look foolish, so I'm going to pretend that I'm just humble. I'm meek. I'm quiet. I'm shy. No, you're not. You're arrogant. You wouldn't call it that, but truth be known, let's call it what it is. Your pride rules your life. We call it an inferiority complex, and the Bible calls it pride. Okay? Let your calling be equal to what Christ has done in you. And the first thing he tells us, get rid of your pride. Think less of yourself. Think right of yourself. There's a tendency to take ownership. My list is short. We could go on about this subject. This is so tantamount to who we are as a species that this is exactly what we need to hear. The Spirit of God needs to break us of our continual desire for my own selfish ends to be met. This is why church fights happen, why church splits take place, why you're upset with your pastor. He's not preaching what I think he should preach. Maybe he isn't. But I know what should be happening. I don't like that. I don't want those hymns. I don't like that song. I need... Why is there church grief in your church? Why? Pride. What is the first calling to our lives? What is the first call to Christian conduct? Humility. What does it look like? Gentleness. Gentleness is a delightful word. What do you think of when you think of gentleness? Often we think of Casper Milquetoast. I don't know if you're familiar with Casper Milquetoast. He made his debut in the 1920s in a comic strip. Here's an example. Mr. Milquetoast knows better than to talk to strangers on vital topics. What do you think of the Dodgers' chances this year? I'd rather not say, if you don't mind. This is why we have the word milquetoast, if you know that English word. It's come into our vocabulary because of this idea of being such a wimp. The wind blows his hat off onto a sign where it says, keep off the grass. Oh, well. I needed a new hat anyway. Today's as good a day as any. Oh, Mr. Milquetoast wouldn't step on the grass. Oh, this is what we often think of with gentleness. Someone who's pale, who's wishy-washy. No. This is not gentleness. This is just called straight up wimpiness. Gentleness is an entirely different critter. Humility and gentleness are kissing cousins. If you want to know what gentleness is, I think the best way to describe it would be found in the cowboy showmanship, the tradition of cowboy showmanship, which is a whole sport in itself that if you're not into and live in the right part of the world, you might not know about. One of the things that you have to do to prove you're a good cowboy is you get your horse to run full gallop into the stadium, and then on cue, you respond to your animal, and your animal responds to you, and your animal comes to a full and complete stop. So this is unnatural to a horse in every way. It takes 2 years for the cowboy to train the horse. Then whatever he does, whatever click-click noise and whatever he does with his feet, the horse immediately puts his four hoofs out, locks his knees, and comes to a skidding stop. Now, to really show off, the cowboy at that point puts the horse in reverse and backs the horse right up. Okay, this is pure showmanship, because the only way this animal would do this if it has complete and utter respect for the cowboy and its trainer. Because what is the natural disposition of a horse? Well, it ain't this. The natural disposition of a horse is to be wild. We have domesticated them. We have changed their personality. And this horse, that naturally speaking, would have the authority, the ability, to buck him off the back, pop his head like a grape, and carry on with his day without a single concern, who has the ability, chooses to curb all of his authority, all of his power, and allows himself to be, in a word, gentle. He has chosen to allow something else to rule him. He is allowing, though he has the right to speak, to use this now to speak about us, you have the right to declare your rights. You have the right to stand up and say something's been done against you. You have the right to make a stink. You have the right. You choose not to. You choose instead to be gentle, to be meek, to be exactly the calling of Christian conduct to which we have been called. This is what is equal, worthy of the calling to which we have been called. Not only humility, but gentleness, willing even to be wronged. Not only this, again, we have a kissing cousin, a word that we all know so very, very well, because this is part and parcel of what it means to be a believer. And it is just the word patience. Macrothumia, this is the word that just means that, long-suffering, forbearance, continuing. This is, again, a compound word. Macro means long. Micro means short. Macro means long. And thymos means passion or anger. So you're long in anger. You're long, you have a long giant fuse, is the idea. You're long in passion. You have the ability to keep your mouth shut. You have the ability to stay in your chair when you want to jump up and throttle someone by the throat. You have the ability to hold your breath and count to 1,000 if you have to. You have the ability to tolerate all kinds of foolishness because you are long suffering. This is the calling to which we have been called. What is our Christian conduct? It is humility, gentleness, patience. And again, right on the heels of this, how else do you say this? What else would be the fruit of this? Bearing with one another. You notice it uses the phrase in love. This is not just, I can tolerate him for 10 seconds. I can put up with this. No. This is where your real test comes. This is really where you put on the fruit of the Spirit and you really seek God for your help, because you are going to tolerate this person in love. And what does that mean? Grace. I don't know what other word to use for this expression. It is simply your ability to provide and allow people room to be just plain stupid. Give people room to just be the weirdo that they are. Give people the room to just do the dumb thing that they do. Do you rebuke them? Maybe there's a time to do so. But by and large, our hearts respond to people with grace. How is it that Paul wants God's people to conduct themselves amongst themselves? What does he call us to? What is the standard of calling? Humility, gentleness, patience, bearing with one another in love. And look at this. I love this word. He says, he uses this word, eager. This is a very good English translation, but it doesn't quite grasp all the subtleties of what this word means. And it has this idea of someone who is making haste or being diligent, being quick, because they're zealous. Zealous is a word that comes out of a heart of love. It's desire to maintain something because you love something. You want to protect something. You are eager, he says, and swift, that's the idea. You move swiftly, you move diligently, you move speedily. Why do you do this? You are eager to maintain. Now, I don't know what you think of when you think of the word maintain in English, but the word maintain to me kind of has this, you know, straight, flat line kind of thing where it's just like, let's just, you know, keep the status quo. Let's just maintain that. Let's just toe the line. That isn't what he means by this. This word means ultimately, in its purest form, to watch over or to guard something, to maintain or preserve something. So spiritually speaking, it means to guard or to keep something intact. So consider these two words together. He is calling us now to be quick, to be swift, to be zealous, to be so in love with something that we are so quick to make sure that we guard, that we maintain, that we hold on to. What is it? Unity. He wants us to be so quick, so swift to maintain the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. We are called to make sure that our behavior, our speech, our action, everything we do amongst ourselves reflects the calling equal to the gospel that's transformed us. And what does it look like? First word, humility, gentleness, patience, bearing with one another, eager to maintain, eager, swift, quick, to hold on to and to guard the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace. What does this unity look like? If you want to know what God's favorite number is, it is one. Look at this text. There's one body, one Spirit, just as you were called to the one hope that belongs to your call, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is over all and in all and through all. One, 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 one. Why does he say this? Because he's calling the church, Jew and Gentile in the book, okay? Jew and Gentile, who, by the way, historically have nothing to do with each other. Nothing. I recently read a missionary newsletter that was celebrating a church service where there were Ukrainians and Russians in the same service, and they were all worshiping Jesus, and not a word was spoken, and not a thing was mentioned about politics, about countries, about anything. And this missionary was celebrating the goodness of God to bring the church together in unity. Well, that is nothing short of exactly what we are called to be. United, regardless of our difference of opinions, regardless of our different backgrounds, regardless of what we think about somebody else, united. One body. Because Christ has made Jew and Gentiles one body. We were separated. We were alienated from Christ. Jews who were born close to him, we've been brought near. It's been one Spirit that did this. The same Spirit that saved the Jew saved the Gentile. There's one hope. It's the same gospel. It's the same belief in Jesus, regardless of your denomination. It's the same hope. It's one Lord. It's the same Jesus. It's the same Jesus we worship. It's the same Jesus we celebrate. And we have the same faith. It's the same faith that saved you, that saved me. We are united together on so many fronts. It is one baptism. It's a work of the Spirit of God that has baptized you into Christ, regardless of whether or not you're a Presbyterian or a Baptist or a Pentecostal. There is one Spirit, one Lord, one faith, one God and Father of all. And so he's calling us, no matter where you're from, this is the code of conduct. This is how we behave. This is how we get along. Let me just tell you the text, and I'll stop talking. You've been very patient. Let me just read it to you again. I, therefore, because of everything that came in the first three chapters, because of everything that Christ has done for you, as a prisoner of the Lord, not of Rome, I am entirely speaking on behalf of the Lord. I'm urging you. I am personally getting on my knees beside you, and I'm begging you. I am personally drawing up alongside you, and I'm asking you to walk in every area of your life, in every single way that it encompasses every decision, every conversation, everything you do, that you would walk in a manner worthy, equal to, that everything you do and say is equal to the calling to which you have been called, that you've been rescued from who you were and made a brand new creature. Now live like it and behave yourself like it. And what does it look like? With humility, putting your pride to death, putting yourself second, thinking less of yourself than your flesh wants to, with gentleness, holding your tongue, keeping control of your attitudes, maintaining patience, being long-suffering, being a person who encourages others, bearing with one another, showing grace to every person you meet and every situation that you're in, grace that lubricates the gears of our relationships. Why would you do this? Why would you behave this way? Because there's one body, one spirit. You were called with one hope that belongs to your call. One Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all. We are one. So behave as one. Act as one. Think as one. We are a unit. Stop your bickering. Stop your fighting. Stop your conniving. Stop trying to politically get your own way in your church. Stop ownership that this is my Sunday school class. This is my church. This is my pew. They're not doing it right. They don't know how to do it. Behave yourself. There is a code of conduct that the church is called to, and we are called to live to the standard of the gospel that is equal to what Christ has done in us. And what does it look like? I just told you. Don't make me say it again. The text is there. And this is who we are called to be. Would you bow your heads with me? Father, we have heard your word. I pray by the Spirit of God, you have rebuked our hearts. You have laid our hearts bare before your word, that you have caused us to recognize our own shortcomings in our pride, in our attitudes towards others, in our lack of patience, and our lack of a desire to be eager to maintain, be willing to stand and to guard the unity that you call us to. Father, we're so quick to bicker, to criticize. We are so quick to stand up and demand our rights, to think we know better. Father, I pray your Spirit would rebuke us today, humble us today, cause us to live according to the standard of conduct that you've called us to. Father, help us in ourselves to confess our sins. Spirit of God, sift us this afternoon. Rebuke us, lay us bare, Father, we pray, and make us to live out the gospel as you called us to live it out, because Jesus needs to be seen in us, and the world needs to see that we are different. We ask this for your glory and your glory alone. Amen.